So I was actually originally going to be presenting at the first workshop up in Cardiff, but then I got the flu a few days beforehand and sent ahead my slides, but I wasn't actually able to go. So when Greg asked me to speak at this one, I said, oh, well, did you use those slides, or can I talk about that stuff again? He said that he didn't really. But what he suggested that he wanted me to do, as someone who uses a variety of different approaches, both kind of discourse, analytic type approaches, and also experimental approaches, was to try to act as somewhat of a bridge between the first workshop and the second workshop. So as I understand the overall project here, phase one of the project was to try to work out and think about what things like humility and arrogance look like, particularly how they look like within public debate or within social interaction. And then the second phase, which I guess is more where it's moving to now, is to try to take the kinds of spotting tools that might have been developed during that first phase and then try to measure the quantity of its occurrence under different kinds of conditions through forms of intervention like self-affirmation. And so I guess what I'm going to talk about today is I'm going to say a little bit about how we might go about trying to spot things like arrogance in particular within social interaction. But then I'm going to reflect a little bit upon some of the, I guess, issues that come up when we try to, well, firstly, when we try to spot these things in interaction. But then secondly, when we then, I guess, take these decontextualized spotting tools and try to look at them in more experimental kinds of contexts. So just to take a sort of step back for a second and to ask a question, which is, what are arrogance and humility? And this is obviously something which we've been wrestling with a bit today, and which those who were involved in the first workshop were also wrestling with. And I guess I want to think about this in an epistemological way. I mean, some of the talks that we've had today, people have been talking about, you know, either explicitly or implicitly, no pun intended there, but I mean, talking about these as being things that we can have, okay, akin to the ways that we would talk about an attitude or a bias, I guess, or a personality trait, or for that matter, the ways we talk about emotional states. So, you know, through this kind of model, we could talk about person X is arrogant or humble, or person X is being arrogant or humble in a very kind of, you know, realist way. And I guess often this is what we seek to be able to do. And so we might look for interactional markers of this trait in a person or this state of a person bubbling over or bubbling to the surface of social interaction. Of course, another way that we might think about it, and the way in which perhaps some others in the room might be more familiar with thinking about it, is these things as actions that we actually perform within social interaction. So in the same way that sort of conversation analysts or discourse analysts will talk about people doing accusations within an interaction, or doing blamings, doing agreement with someone, doing an assessment of something within an interaction. Okay. In the same way, we could think about the performance of arrogance and humility in a similar kind of fashion. Okay. We could say that person X has done arrogance there, or done humility, and we might analyse how people achieve a performance of arrogance, or how they do being arrogant, or do being humble within an interaction. And an interesting side point about humility, I mean, there was some interesting discussion earlier about, you know, is humility necessarily a great thing? And there was this sense in which, you know, you could be sort of, I can't remember what the term was, but kind of personally debasing yourself or something like that. I mean, I guess another thing to consider is that sometimes people do being humble within interaction in ways which we actually find quite annoying, don't they? I mean, there are times when someone sort of stands up and says, oh, well, I mean, you see people doing this all the time, sort of self-handicapping that goes on, or kind of disingenuous, what we might read as disingenuous humility, okay, which we wouldn't necessarily be wanting to promote as such. So there's kind of tensions there. Okay, so two slightly different ways of epistemological ways of thinking about what arrogance and humility might be. And then I guess there's a third way, which I'm not going to kind of dwell on, but those involved in the wider project might be interested to consider. And that's thinking about arrogance and humility as concepts that we invoke directly in social interaction in order to achieve international business. So in the same way that discourse analysts have looked at identity categories such as, you know, being a mother, okay, people might actually say in interaction, well, speaking as a mother or speaking as a parent, okay, or they might do the same with emotional states. When you said that, you made me angry, or you hurt my feelings. Okay, this is actually doing interactional business. It's holding that person accountable for their actions by virtue of invoking the idea of anger. And I guess you could potentially say, you are being arrogant. Right? That is an option that's available to us within social interaction. It has an interactional life of its own as a concept. So here we might say that person X has actually put arrogance or humility as a concept or as a construct to work in interaction. Okay, so since it's kind of late in the day, I thought, and this was something that apparently was the intention in the first workshop, was to spend quite a lot of time on this, but Greg said that there was never really that much time. So I'm going to play you a 20-second clip from Newsnight. I'm not going to give you the context, actually, intentionally, okay, but we've got some, I guess, community / political leaders here having a debate. This will work.
I defend his right to do it. I think violent threats, etc., are outrageous. The issue here is, it wasn't an other Libs MPPC tweeting the cartoon. That is true.
No.
I do have a problem with that.
What was offensive about the cartoon because you saw on our screen tonight? Is that the only one I tweeted?
Because that was one part of a series of cartoons.
That's the only one I tweeted. What did you find offensive?
If I tweet one page from a book, it doesn't mean I don't represent the rest of the book. Come on, Majid.
Of course it doesn't.
Come on, Majid. You know perfectly well
the
wider cartoon.
Every single view of everyone you ever quote. What? Do you believe in every single view of everyone you ever quote?
I'm not here to debate the cartoon. Right. You can debate it with Mo. I don't even care about the cartoon.
You clearly do.
Well, Mo,
okay.
Okay, so I actually think this is a really fascinating little 20-second clip in terms of thinking about the ways in which arrogance in particular might be conceptualized within social interaction. Okay, so I'm just going to play that 20 seconds again, but this time you can sort of start trying to look at, okay, well, where might we spot or point to things that people are doing interactionally which we might perceive to be potentially intellectually arrogant?
It's about the cartoon we saw on our screen tonight. Is that the only one I tweeted?
Because that was one part of a series of cartoons.
That's the only one I tweeted. What did you find offensive?
If I tweet one page from a book, it doesn't mean I don't represent the rest of the book. Come on, Majid.
Of course it doesn't.
Come on, Majid. You know perfectly well
the
wider cartoon
is about. Every single view of everyone you ever quote? What? Do you believe in every single view of everyone you ever quote?
I'm not here to debate the cartoon. You can debate it with Mo. I don't even care about the cartoon.
You clearly do.
Well, Majid,
okay.
You can imagine that was quite fun to try to transcribe. I remember doing that with the flu before the previous workshop, which is why I wanted to make sure that we used this. Okay, so what are some things that we might notice here? Well, the first thing that we notice is overlapping talk, as indicated by these things in brackets, you know, people talking over the top of one another, okay, not conforming to the turn-taking rules of conversation, which is in some ways the kind of base level thing, going back to, you know, not behaving, I can't remember what the French expression was earlier, was it not being an asshole or whatever. I mean, this, you know, this is kind of one thing that we might point to, or, I mean, this thing, which a lot of you kind of laughed at, this, I mean, I would note the fact that this was someone using a pause, actually, to kind of do confusion, right? So in response to someone saying, do you believe in every single view of everyone you ever quote? There's this 1 second pause before they then go, what? And actually the 1 second pause is a way of kind of saying, oh my God, that I don't even know what to say to that. I can't even make sense of what you just said. And using people's names, okay? There are certainly ways in which we can use people's names that are really nice and potentially even sort of flirtatious and whatever else, but these are not those ways, okay? And we all kind of know this from interactions when we're debating with people. You know, the point at which someone says to me, oh, Tim, right? Or sometimes you make a point that you think is important, and, you know, I had a former colleague who used to do this, they'd go, oh, Tim, right? These kinds of things, infuriating. Okay. So, I mean, these are just the kind of micro ways in which people can do arrogance within interaction. Well, these are just things that I noticed from the 22nd clip that was sent around before the last workshop. And I'm sure that there's, you know, probably advanced literatures on these. Also, making claims to have knowledge of others' psychological states. Okay. You know perfectly well what the cartoons were about, is an example of this. Or in response to, I don't even care about the cartoons. Well, you clearly do because you said you found them offensive. Okay, these are just other examples of this. And constructing one's own position as self-evident. Okay, this, well, of course it doesn't. Of course it doesn't. Of course what I'm saying is correct. Okay, so having sort of set up that idea that we might, you know, kind of luring you into this idea that, oh, this is great, these are the kinds of things that we can code for. I guess I just want to problematize that a little bit. And, I mean, I presented you with something with not really much content. But surely the topic of debate is important to how we read the behaviour of others and whether we read it as arrogant or, for that matter, humble. But I'm going to focus particularly on arrogance. So, are there situations where otherwise arrogant behaviour, and this, I guess, is linking particularly to the points that Kosher was making, ways in which arrogant behaviour within interaction might sometimes not be perceived negatively by others, or perceived more or less negatively by others? Are there situations where people see it as being called for, as it were? So, I'm going to set up the idea for these experimental studies that I did with a former PhD student of mine, Katerina Stenches, by telling you about, very quickly, two experiences in my life. Okay, the first was when I was in my early 20s and I was staying in a backpacker's hostel in Berlin, I think it was, as part of a round-the-world trip funded by my university. and, I mean, backpacker's hostels are interesting places because they are situations where you do come into contact with people with potentially vastly different views, and where you're meeting people that you've never met before, and you're kind of forced to talk to people. It's a bit like going to a conference, but where everyone doesn't kind of go there with all of this shared common ground. And I was sitting in this backpacker's hostel, and there was this one guy, I won't say what country he was from, but he told this joke, and he said, he said, people were telling jokes, and he said, oh, and I mean, this is pretty offensive, right? So just, I find it quite offensive, but it's like the stereotypical horrendous racist joke where he said, well, so how do you stop a black man drowning? Take your foot off his head, right? Horrendous. And I basically let fly at this guy, is probably a good way of putting it. I mean, I just basically said, look, I can't believe that you just told that joke. I'm really offended by that. I'm sorry, that's not acceptable. And then all the other people there basically, you know, sort of agreed with me and sort of came to my defense in a way. And this guy ended up obviously feeling kind of socially ostracized in this situation. Fast forward to about 2007, I found myself at a barbecue. This was when I was still working in Australia. This is not the actual barbecue, as evidenced by the fact that it has a stupid English barbecue there instead of a proper Australian version. And there were these two young women there who were actually British backpackers on a working holiday for a year, and they were talking about about how hot it was in Perth, and they said that that summer they had intentionally left the air conditioning unit in the house they were living on for the entire 4 months of summer, because that's how long summer actually lasts in some places, believe it or not, on full bore the whole time, 24/7, because they just thought that was a cool thing to do. And they were laughing about the fact that, do you remember when we used to have to get up in the morning and put our fleeces on because it was so cold, even though it was 40 degrees outside? And, I mean, this was just after the fourth assessment report from the IPCC. I was doing research on climate change at the time. And again, maybe lost it a little bit. And just kind of said, you know, that's not funny, that's some other word starting with F and blah, blah, blah. And I basically had a go at them. And they had a go back at me. But the interesting thing was the reaction of the other people to this behaviour, which was for people to kind of go, it was very similar to this one. It was kind of, oh, this is a bit awkward. But it was like I'd been awkward, right? I had been the awkward one in that situation. That was at least the way that I came away from it feeling in comparison to this situation. But of course, there's lots of, you know, that's not obviously not a controlled experiment. What Katerina and I were interested in looking at was the way in which we can understand social norms and the role of social norms in changing the way that people think and behave about certain things through studying how people respond to their to the confrontation of violation of these norms within social interaction. And so we did actually have a non-vignette style study later on, but you'll have to give me Rob, this one is actually a vignette study. So the basic paradigm was that our participants were told that they had been working in a group project throughout the semester, and at the end they'd had to give a presentation in the last week. This had gone really well, and the group had gone to the pub or the cafe to celebrate afterwards. Conversation was kind of flowing, and for whatever reason, the topic got on to talking about issues to do with, you know, people of different ethnicities and whatnot. And one person, Sam, says, I really couldn't give a damn, oh, and by the way, this was all, they weren't giving pictures, this is just for your benefit. I really couldn't give a damn about racial equality. To be honest, I intentionally go out of my way to be as rude as I can to immigrants from other countries. Right? I mean, I didn't really think that we could, you know, have him telling joke about, you know, putting, taking feet off people's heads. But fairly extreme. And then another person in the group, then is presented as saying, and this is Alex, says, how can you even think something like that? I can't believe you just made such a stupid comment. Right? And then in a different part of the design, in the no confrontation condition, same comment made by Sam, but then Alex says, really? That's interesting. What makes you say that? Okay, so in other words, kind of doesn't agree with it, but lets it kind of go through to the keeper. Okay. So you might start to think about, all right, what do you think of Alex in these two situations? But what if the topic of conversation was different? Okay, so in the other half of the design, Sam says something very similar, but on a different topic. I really couldn't give a damn about climate change. To be honest, I intentionally go out of my way to do as many environmentally damaging things as I can. Okay, and Alex again says, how can you even think something like that? I just can't believe you'd make such a stupid comment. In other words, in comparison to perhaps the saying no to racism in the earlier condition, it's kind of saying no to climate change in a sense. And then again, we have the no confrontation condition where Alex says the same thing. Really, that's interesting. What makes you say that? Now, two important things before I give you the results. Firstly, participants all thought that Alex, so the person who responded, disagreed with Sam's position. Okay, so that they were all clear that Alex always disagreed with Sam. Okay, the participants themselves all generally disagreed with Sam's position, whether it was Sam making the sort of racial inequality comment or the kind of environmentally disregarding comment. But the key question that we were interested in is, what did they think of Alex? What did they think of the person who either confronted, potentially quite rudely and arrogantly, or just kind of, you know, did the, oh, well, we can all agree to disagree on this issue, okay? And we measured two particular things, these questions to do with how socially close they would want to be to Alex, and also warmth. I'll just present social closeness data for brevity. The results are pretty much the same for warmth. So, in the case of when Alex was kind of saying no, just saying no to climate change, you can see that Alex was actually liked less, one could say, when he responded with confrontation. How can you even say something like that? Or how can you even think something like that? Can't believe you just made such a stupid comment. Okay, that was preferable in a way. That reflected better on Alex than when Alex made this response. Sorry, the way around. That reflected worse on Alex than when Alex just let it go through the keyboard. People preferred congenial Alex, as it were, in this situation. So you might be thinking, well, that's just because people don't like people that stand up for things and violate normative rules of politeness, especially in Britain. Okay, but that wasn't what we found in the racism condition. Okay, these weren't even significantly different, but if anything, okay, the pattern is more in the opposite direction. People actually prefer Alex, just as was the case with my experience all those years ago, preferred Alex who actually confronted, okay, who basically shut someone down and said, I'm not even going to entertain your perspective or position on this. And what we found was that these different reactions to the two issues, or the different reactions to the confrontation of the two issues, was mediated by the extent to which participants perceived that issue as having moral valence or being morally relevant. Okay, so so people perceived racial equality as having higher moral valence, and it was that drove this interaction between response and issue. Okay, so perhaps getting even closer to what the project is most interested in, does the level of politeness of the confrontation make a difference? Okay, so in a later study, it wasn't so much a hypothetical vignette. We gave participants what they believed was a transcript of a focus group that we had actually run a few months earlier. Okay, and we basically created the same kind of, interaction for them to perceive. But what we manipulated here was the politeness of the confrontation. So in the impolite version, okay, Sam is sort of having his spiel here, this is in the climate change condition, but he actually gets cut off, or he or she, we use gender non-specific names, gets cut off by Alex, who interjects and says, well, I'm really shocked about that, etc., etc. Bearing in mind that this is in the context of a focus group, okay, where perhaps that's a bit less normative to do. In the more polite condition, Sam gets to finish his position, okay, and then there's no interjection there, and Alex just sort of says, And then the moderator of the focus group says, Alex, did you have something to add? So he's invited to give his position, or her position, and Alex then says the same thing. Okay, so that's the more polite confrontation. And then in the no confrontation condition, it's the same as the previous one, except Alex's response is different, saying, well, I'm not sure I agree, but I'm interested to hear more about Sam's position on this. What makes you say that, Sam? And then the racial prejudice condition was basically the same, but the topic of the focus group was all different, et cetera, et cetera. And then there was the three different kinds of confrontation, or not, by Alex. And what we found was that one can be as rude as one wants, or arrogant, perhaps, if we want to try to use that term, when confronting racism, okay? So there was basically still no difference. So there wasn't really a difference between being polite and impolite. It didn't come at a social cost to the way that you were perceived. In the confrontation of environmental disregard condition, we can see that being polite helped a little bit in terms of whether people still wanted to, you know, be your friend and work with you again and all these kinds of things. So it helped a bit, but you were still significantly less liked when you confronted on that issue, even if you tried to be a bit more polite about it. So, this work was not actually conducted with an original aim of setting out to look at responses to arrogance, okay? And we never actually directly measured perceived arrogance. I kind of wish that we had now. but I guess the reason why I thought it might just be interesting to throw into the mix is that it does show how exactly the same discursive manoeuvres can lead to different kinds of perceptions of the speaker as a function of the topic of debate. I guess it sort of links to some of the stuff that you were talking about, Gosha, in terms of when are people willing to accept arrogance, or when do people set a higher bar for humility as well. Okay, and I guess the other reason why I thought it might be interesting is to kind of bring in the idea of morality and the fact that the perception of the moral valence of a topic, at least from the individual's perspective, from an onlooker's perspective, greatly affects how speech acts are responded to. I guess both cognitively, but I suppose we might also think about how that might happen interactionally as well. And I think this has potential implications for the project, in the sense that, you know, if you're trying to and engage in attempts to sport arrogance in a more sort of empiricist, conversation analytic, or ethno-methodological way, which I know sort of went on a little bit in the first workshop. In other words, assuming that there is almost nothing beyond the transcript, I think this, you know, maybe problematizes that perspective a little bit. And I guess, leading on from some of the talks this morning, earlier this afternoon, I think it maybe forces us to think about how willing we are to kind of push the boundaries as researchers in terms of what kinds of open-mindedness or what things we might be willing to encourage people to be open-minded towards.